Good to see all of you this morning. I appreciate so much your interest in the things that we're studying. There's so many fascinating things when we study these Old Testament kings. I hope that, well, I want you to be as excited about the study of this period of time as I am or can get, because it's an exciting period. We learn so much about the providence of God during the time of these kings and the bringing about of His plan to save man. And I think sometimes we become so focused on a particular story or incident in history that we forget about how it fits into the overall plan of God to save man. And consequently, we fail to see or fail to be impressed with the value of the lessons from that. But if you would please open your Bibles to 2 Kings. 2 Kings, we're going to start our study this morning, in chapter 7. Chapter 7, we'll review that just briefly, and then I want to pass on to some other things. So if you would please open your Bibles to that, 2 Kings chapter 7. In our study last time, in fact the last couple of times, we've been talking about the works of Elisha. We know that Elisha was the successor of Elijah, the Old Testament prophet. And we have talked about Naaman the leper. And we have talked about in the sixth chapter how that the axe head floated. We talked about the famine that occurred in Samaria as a result of the invasion of Ben-Hadad. And in our study this morning, I want to just reiterate a little bit from the text of the seventh chapter and then move on into the eighth chapter. In the seventh chapter, we studied about the famine that existed in the city of Samaria as a result of the invasion of King Hadad. And we noted that they were buying the head of an ass that they might boil the meat off of it to eat for what would be the equivalent of about 80 days' wages. That's a whole lot of money, isn't it, to spend for something that you normally would throw out. You wouldn't eat it. And in the text of the sixth chapter, we noted that there was a problem. King Jehoram, king of Israel, was instructed that there were two women that were fussing with each other, and he raises the question, what's the problem? And one of them says, we've made a deal that we would eat my son today, and or yesterday, and we would eat her son today. And so you can see how bad the famine was. Now her issue was, we ate my son yesterday, and today she's not willing for us to eat her son. And King Jehoram was very disturbed by all of this. Yet we don't really see an attitude of repentance on his part. We note in the seventh chapter, and if you'll back up to the last verse of the sixth chapter, it says, while he was yet talking with them, behold, the messenger came down to him and said, behold, this evil is of Jehovah. Why should I wait for Jehovah any longer? And Elisha said, hear ye the word of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah, tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel and two measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. Then the captain on whose hand the king leaned answered the man of God and said, behold, if Jehovah should make windows in heaven, this thing, or might this thing be? And he said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shall not eat thereof. Now we've discussed that from the entirety, really, of the seventh chapter. And there we learned that the lepers of Samaria had gone out of the city, and their determination was, if we stay in the city, we're going to die. And we're lepers, we're going to die. And if we go to the Syrians, the worst thing that can happen to us is we're going to die. But perchance they might save our lives. And so they went to the Syrian camp, but they didn't find the Syrians. What did they find?
All their stuff,
that's right. The Syrians had deserted the camp. God had caused them to hear a noise of an army, and they thought they were about to be overthrown. So they left everything, and they went back towards Syria.
and left all their tents, their gold, their silver, their food, everything. They left it behind and just went on. And these lepers began to go from tent to tent and gather things up and hide it for themselves. And they said, we're not doing right. We need to go back and tell folks. And so they did. And when they sent out and gathered up all that the Syrians had left, now this is a very brief paraphrase of this whole chapter, but when they gathered up all the things that the Syrians left and piled it at the gate of Samaria, we find that fine flour was indeed sold for a minimal price. And now they're able to eat and to eat the things that the Syrians have left. And the irony of that is the captain who had said, if God opens the windows of heaven, this will never be. And Elisha said, it'll happen, and it'll happen tomorrow, and you'll see it, but you won't get to partake of it. Well, why not? What happened to the captain? He got trampled to death. That's right. All this food now piled amongst a bunch of folks that are starving to death, and he gets trampled to death. Yes.
I know you're just summarizing, but what,
very
you,
much.
But what you left out was why the Syrians left the camp to begin with.
Okay, they heard the sound of an army.
Which is really interesting. Here.
Yeah.
Chapter 7, verse 6.
Yes.
Lord caused the armies of the Arameans in my translation to hear a sound of chariots and the sound of horses, even the sound of a great army. So they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel is hired against us, the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. They thought they were going to be overrun by chariots and horses.
Well, that's right. And of course, there is you can see why they're fleeing. If we stay and gather our things together, we'll be killed. So they're just fleeing for their lives. That's right. And we need to be impressed with that. Because this was how God preserved Samaria, at least at this point. We'll see later that it was not. But relief from the famine was indeed prophesied. Now that brings us to the 8th chapter, and I want to look there for just a moment. In the 8th chapter, it tells us that Elisha had spoken unto the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, arise, and go thou and thy household, and sojourn whithersoever or wheresoever thou canst sojourn, for Jehovah hath called for a famine, and it shall also come upon the land 7 years. Now I want us to observe that the events that we're reading about here just simply are used to help us to understand the works of Elisha. They're not necessarily intended to be in chronological order, that this event, then this event, and so forth. But Elisha is telling this woman, whose son he has brought back to life, that you need to leave because there's going to be a famine. And where does she go? She goes down to the Philistines. And the Philistines, as you recall, the land of Philistia was located, I thought I had a map there, it was located on a coast. And so it would seem that they would have somewhat more moisture, here's a map, than they did in Samaria. Now, Samaria is somewhere, right there it is. And here's where the woman went, somewhere over here in the land of the Philistines. And she was gone for the length of the period of famine.
But the Philistines were enemies.
Yes. Evidently. Yes. Evidently they didn't perceive her as a threat. So they evidently let her stay there, which is interesting in and of itself. But yes. So at the end of the 7 years, let me get back to my chart, she comes back to Samaria. Now what has happened while she's been away?
Her land was sold.
Yes. Her land was sold. Now, there was a law regarding the land, the inheritance of the fathers. We just talked about that as we discussed Naaman. Ahab and his desire to have Naboth's. I get Naboth and Naaman turned around sometimes. Naboth's vineyard. And Naboth wouldn't sell it to him because he said, that's my inheritance. And we discussed at that point how that they were to maintain their own land, the family's land. Well, this woman being gone now for 7 years, the famine seems to have ceased, and she comes back and she wants her land. And this I find to be quite interesting. When you look at the 8th chapter, there is a rehearsal of the deeds of
Elisha, the prophet, before King Jehoram, the son of Ahaziah, son of Ahaziah in Judah. And the discussion then is, what about this woman? What about the works of Elisha? Yes. This is the this would be in Israel, so you're right, it would be the son of Ahab. Yeah, in Israel. Yes, thank you. Yes, would be the son of Ahab. But Elisha, his works are being rehearsed, thank you, before the king, and as Gehazi, don't laugh at me, I'm just doing the best. I'm going to really throw you some curves. But Gehazi is telling the king about the events of Elisha the prophet. And one of the events that Elisha tells him about is how that, or that Gehazi tells him about is how that Elisha raised this woman's son. And lo and behold, the timing of the thing is interesting. In walks this Shunammite woman, and you can see Gehazi pointing his finger, so to speak, at the woman and say, well, there's the woman and there's her son that was raised from the dead. And she expresses her desire to have her land back. And what does the king then do?
Restores
her land, yes. Well, it is her land, and this was the right thing to do. So the land then is given to her. Now, picking it up at verse 7, Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, tells us that Elisha came to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick. And it was told him, saying, the man of God come hither. And the king said unto Hazael, take a present in thy hand, and go meet the man of God, and inquire of Jehovah, by him, saying, shall I recover this illness? Now, picture again in your mind the order of the events. Hazael is the servant to the king. What king? Ben-Hadad. That's right, king of Syria. And the king of Syria tells Hazael to go down and talk to this prophet and find out whether I'm going to get well or not. And what does the prophet tell him?
He says, tell him he's going to get well, but he's not.
Yes, he's going to get well, but he's going to die. He's going to get well from this illness. But, ultimately, he's going to die. Now, we find that the reaction of the prophet is, he begins to cry. And Hazael wants to know, why are you crying? And what does the prophet then tell him? Why was the prophet crying?
Because I know what you're going to do.
I know what you're going to do. Now look, if you will, at what he says he's going to do in verse 12. It says, and Hazael said, why weepeth my Lord? And he answered, because I know the evil that thou wilt do unto the children of Israel. Their strongholds wilt thou set on fire, and their young men wilt thou slay with the sword, and wilt dash in pieces their little ones, and rip up their women with child. Well, that sounds nasty, doesn't it? Here are things that were common occurrence in war during these times. But Hazael said, but why is thy servant, or what rather is thy servant, who is but a dog that should do this great thing? Now, how does Hazael consider himself? He reacts adversely to the words of the prophet.
Yeah,
what do you think I am? Some kind of a dog that I would treat people like this? Well, knowing now that...
He's not calling himself a dog in a negative sense. He's calling himself a dog in a lowly sense. In other words, I'm just a servant. I couldn't possibly do these things because the king is the one who does these things.
Well, he ultimately does these things.
Yes, he does.
Certainly so. And how he considers himself, I'm not certain that... He's just simply humble here. my reason for that, I wouldn't take issue with that, but my reason for thinking perhaps it's beyond that is what he does just as soon as he gets home.
I would say he obviously must have had the thought in his mind that somebody doesn't just up and, you know, do something like that. So he may be overcompensating. What? Me? I'm nobody. Why would I do something like that?
Yeah, yeah. But then what does he do? He goes home and tells the king, you're going to get well. But in verse 15, it came to pass on the morrow that he took the coverlet and dipped it in water and spread it on his face so that he died. And Hazael reigned in his stead.
That sounds like someone who was wanting to be the king.
It does. I mean, he doesn't wait months down the pike for Ben-Hadad to make some more major decisions or something in his role as king. He goes the next day and kills him. And I find that a bit of irony because not just simply from the standpoint of what the prophet has said, but it indicates the kind of character that Hazael is. How do you get to become king? We've talked about this before during these days in the northern kings. You kill the king that's there, and now you declare yourself king. And isn't that what Hazael did? Now, one of the things I want to note just here is that was the beginning of a new dynasty in Syria. That stopped that. And now we've got Hazael who becomes king. Now, the prophet Elisha, his concern is that when you become king, these are all the ugly things you're going to do to my people, the people of Israel. And that's what he ultimately does. Now, I want to pause in our study here of the kings for just a moment, as far as the details are concerned, and look at this chart again. I want this chart to be before us at least enough times that we can follow through with who belongs to who, okay?
One more thing before you get to the chart.
Okay.
Verse 15, I've kind of struggled with that every time we look at it. Was Ben-Hadad smothered?
Yes.
Because my version of the New American Standard says he took the cover and dipped it in water and spread it on his face so that he died.
Yes.
You cleaned your face like a plastic bag.
Yeah, what would you do if somebody took a thick cloth and wet it and put it over your face?
Die.
You'd die. You couldn't breathe.
He smothered
him to death. Yeah. That's what he did to him.
But he didn't recover.
He didn't recover. No. Not from this.
But he would.
Yeah. He didn't die of his illness. He was murdered. So that's what we want to take home with us. Now, and aside from that, we want to follow these kings, okay? And I'm going to tell you what we're going to talk about. And on this chart, and then we were going to look at the text and study it, okay? Now stay with me on this, because this is really important to see the relevance of who is king when. Alright? We've got the lineage of Judah over here with King David. Now down the pike, down the lineage, we've got Jehoshaphat. And we know that Jehoshaphat had a son named Jehoram. Jehoram became king then in Judah. We've got Omri over here in Israel. He had a son whose name was Ahab. You recall he was married to a wicked Jezebel. Ahab had several children, but we have three that are named in the text. A daughter, Athaliah, a son, Jehoram, and a son, Ahaziah.
So Jehoram was a brother-in-law.
That is correct. Yes, that is correct. Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab, married Jehoram over here. So yes, Jehoram over here, son of Jehoshaphat, king in Judah, has a brother-in-law named Jehoram over here, who later became king. After he became king, not far down the pike, this man became king. But first, Ahab's son Ahaziah became king. Okay? After Ahaziah became king, when he died, his brother Jehoram became king. So we've still got the lineage of Ahab. Athaliah now, married to Jehoram over here, have a son. And they name him after her brother. Okay? Ahaziah. Same name. Jehoram and Athaliah have a son named Ahaziah.
Now, where we're going with this is to see that down the pike, there's a man by the name of Jehu. Now, we've already been introduced to Jehu, at least his name. You remember when Elijah had slain the prophets of Baal in toward the end of the contest at Mount Carmel there in 1 Kings chapter 18? You remember that? You remember in the 19th chapter of 1 Kings how that Jezebel said, by tomorrow your life is going to be like one of them. And Elijah the prophet fled away. And he wound up hiding in a cave way down, miles, miles, miles away from Samaria. And God raised the question to Elijah, what doest thou here? Remember that? And Elijah began to explain that things are not good. I've tried to serve you, and they've slain the prophets with the edge of the sword, and I only am left alone. Just me. Well, now, often in our text of chapter 19, we emphasize that, no, that really wasn't true. Elijah wasn't all alone, that there were yet 7,000 who had not bowed the knee to Baal. But that's not all that's in that. There are some details that we want to go back and dig up that'll be real helpful to us now in our study of these chapters of 2 Kings. Go back, if you will, to 1 Kings chapter 19 and pick up the reading in verse 15. 2 Kings 19, verse 15. Now, one of the things that Elijah certainly is discouraged. And he's already expressed in verse 4 his desire to just die. He's had enough. But God told him, I've got something yet for you to do. And if you will, Randy, pick up the reading and read for me verses 15 through 17, please.
1 Kings 19, 15 through 17. The Lord said to him, go and return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael, king over Aram. I guess your version says Syria. Right?
Okay.
And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Melo, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. It shall come about the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death.
All right, let's pause right there. What job does God have for the prophet Elijah? Appoint some people. Now, we have seen that Elisha was appointed. He became prophet. And he was the one who said to Hazael that Ben-Hadad is going to die. And he went up there and he killed Ben-Hadad, and now Hazael has become king. And we know then that later Jehu becomes king. Now that's way down the pipe. But what is the purpose of these men, in particular Hazael and Jehu, becoming king? What did Hazael do? What did Elisha know he would do? You're going to kill all sorts of people. You're going to fight against Israel. Now keep in mind, we're talking about the northern kingdom here. What was it that the northern kingdom was doing?
Worshipping idols.
And this problem that Elijah has had with them has been the result of their worship of idols. Baal in particular. This contest was because of that. And you would think then that they would know and understand, as they have affirmed, Jehovah, He is God. He is God. But did they stay with that?
No.
No, they didn't stay with that. Now, Hazael became king of Syria, and that's exactly what he did. He fought with the people of Israel, and Elisha knew he would do that. Why? Because the people of Israel are worshiping idols. And this is God's judgment upon the people of Israel. Do we see that? Now look further at our chart up here. We know that Jehoram, his son Ahaziah, becomes king. Who teaches Ahaziah how to run the kingdom?
His mom.
his mother, Athaliah. Look at who she is now, the daughter of Ahab. What does she know about God? Nothing. Nothing. Idolatrous to the core. What then does she teach Ahaziah? She teaches him about idolatry. So it just goes further and further and further and further. And here's what you have in Judah. But then over here, we've got idolatry from the beginning, all the way back to Jeroboam. But Ahab sets a new benchmark for wickedness and worshiping of idols. And what did God say he would do to the house of Ahab? Now we're going to go back and fill in all the blanks in a little bit. What would he do? Going to destroy the house of Ahab. Now, what does that mean, to destroy one's house?
End of the dynasty.
That's right. Children, grandchildren, not going to be any sitting on the throne. Okay? Now, we did note that Ahab had a son that sat on the throne, Ahaziah. What happened to him?
He died.
His brother, Jehoram, became king. He's sitting on the throne. Now we do know, and we'll look at the passages, where Jehoram, there was a period of time when both of them served as king at the same time. Now when you're reading from the text, don't get lost in that. You can study that very carefully by noting whether or not the man's name Jehoram is described as the son of Jehoshaphat. If it is, you know who that is. If he's described as king of Judah, then you know who that is. If he's described as the king of Israel, you know that it's this man, the son of Ahab. Now that won't always be explained in the text, so you read back, you read a little farther, see who you're talking about. It'll make a lot more sense to you, and you won't get nearly as confused. Yes, David? Well, in essence, yes, but the point being here, they're going to be killed. All of your descendants are going to be killed. So there won't be anybody else. They're all going to be killed. Now, just to kind of get it on the board for us, but get it mapped out where we're going. We know that Jehu was indeed appointed to be king. But when he was appointed to be king, who was serving as king? Jehoram, over here. Now, Jehu came along during this man's life, the son of Jehoram, and this man, Ahaziah, made an alliance with his uncle Jehoram to fight against the Syrians. You know, if we've got a common enemy, that makes us friends, right? But, see, we've got this family relationship that ties them to Ahaziah and his uncle Jehoram. We've got Athaliah married to Ahaziah's father, and what is it that Ahaziah is taught? The things that Athaliah believes. So he's got more in common with his uncle than he did with his grandfather, Jehoshaphat, who served the Lord. Now, when Jehu comes along, this battle between or involving Ahaziah and his alliance with Jehoram as they fight against the Syrians injure Jehoram. Don't kill him, but he's wounded. And he goes back to Jezreel to heal up from his wounds. King Ahaziah, down here in Jerusalem, decides he wants to go up and see his uncle and see if he's healing up all right. And guess what happens while he's there?
New king's appointed.
Jehu. Well, that's where it goes. Jehu
comes up there to Jezreel, where he draws back his bow and lets go of an arrow, and it hits old Jehoram right in the back and comes out through his heart. So what happened to the son of Ahab?
He died.
He did. But we've got Ahaziah over here, who is the grandson of Ahab. What does Jehu order his men to do to him? Kill him. And so now we've got the son and the grandson of Ahab dead. Now we know that Ahab had several other children that are not named in the text. We find that there were 70 of them. And when Jehu came to the city where the 70 sons were, what did he order be done, or I'm going to kill all of you? That's right. You kill those sons and send their heads out to me. And so they beheaded them and sent them out in a basket.
To back up just a little bit, Jehu is another son of Jehoshaphat?
No.
I'm looking back in...
He's the son of Jehoshaphat, but not this Jehoshaphat. That's another thing we're going to need to talk about. I believe there are possibly six Jehoshaphats in the Old Testament. And Jehu's father is identified as Jehoshaphat, but not this one.
So what's his connection? Is he a servant, a soldier? I'm trying to find
out. I'll have to go back and study that some more. I think he's outside the loop of the family over here.
He was a captain in the army.
He was a captain, yes.
So he's
that's true.
One of these, just like today, somebody wants to have a coup.
Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But look what God has selected him to do this. And so my point is, what are the odds of Ahaziah and Jehoram being in the same city at the same time when Jehu marches on that city? And not just Ahaziah and Jehu, but these 70 sons of Ahab as well. And if you look at the text in chapter 10 now of 2 Kings, it says in verse 7 that it came to pass when the letter came to them that they took the king's sons and slew them, even 70 persons, and put their heads in baskets and sent them unto him to Jezreel. Now, that's just fascinating to me. Why? Why is that so important? What had God said he would do to the house of Ahab? I'm going to cut it off. There won't be any lineage from the house of Ahab. Now, how did that come to play? Jehu was to be anointed by Elijah, and Jehu would take care of business. Hazael was to be appointed by Elijah, and Hazael would take care of business. Elijah. Hazael would be appointed by Elijah, but that didn't occur until the days of Elisha. Don't let me throw you. Elijah was supposed to, but Elisha did. 1 Kings 19, verse
17. The one who escapes the sword of Israel, Jehu shall put death. Before that, though.
Verse 16.
If Jehu, the son of Dimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel, Meloah, who shall anoint the prophet of Israel. Jehoshaphat, the one who escapes from the sword of Israel, and Jehu shall put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, and Elisha shall put to death. So Elisha doesn't do any anointing.
Elijah.
Elisha doesn't do any anointing in the prophecy.
In the prophecy.
But if you'll turn to 2 Kings 9, you see where he does. It says, and Elisha the prophet called one of the sons of the prophets and said unto him, gird up thy loins and take this vial of oil in thy hand and go to Ramoth Gilead
And when thou comest, look out there, Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him arise up from among his brethren and carry him to an inner chamber. Then take this vial of oil and pour it on his head and say, Thus saith Jehovah, I have anointed thee king over Israel. Then open the door and flee and tarry not.
So Elisha didn't even do that. He called one of the sons of the prophets and had him.
Right, that's correct.
Some nameless prophet or son of a prophet.
So he told him, anoint his king and run away.
Run away, yeah. Now you can see why. You know, you're going to go into all these highfalutin folks, and you're going, that's Kentucky talk. You're going to go into these officials, and you're going to say, Jehu, you're king. Yeah. What about the lineage of Ahab? Not going to be any. Okay? Because Jehu's going to take care of that. Now, do you see this involving the providence of God at all? When you study Old Testament history, God said, here's what's going to happen. And here's how it's going to play out. And here are the characters that are going to be involved in the carrying out of my will and the judgment upon the northern 10 tribes, the people of Israel. Now we've got the men named that would be the participants. And we see then how it plays out. That the descendants, all of them, of Ahab are killed. And the house of Ahab is cut off, and Jehu establishes a new dynasty in Israel. Now, when you're reading from the text, you know now what to expect to read about. And you'll be reading that in these next few chapters of 2 Kings, okay? And in your lesson book, you'll see that paralleled with the Chronicles. And I would really encourage you to read all of that, because there are some details that you pick up in the Chronicles that you don't get in the Kings. Some very important details. Okay? Now, is everybody confused? You are? Okay. Well, I can see how it would be confusing. But we'll have to wade through it as we go through the text, okay? Yes.
Well, the general rule, as you've brought up many times, is that God said from the very beginning, you serve me, I'll bless you. You serve me, I'll curse you.
That's right.
And that's exactly what plays out every single time.
Every single time. You're very familiar, most of you are, with my illustration of the big burly fellow on the other side of the door, and you're warned that if you go through the door, he's going to whack you. How many times is it going to take you going through the door until you figure out there's got to be another door? How many times are you going to have to be whacked? Well, that raises all kinds of questions to Israel. Can't you look at your past and see that this rule is consistent? Now, with the period of the kings, this just demonstrates the providence of God and how He carries out just exactly what He says He's going to do. Now, I want to raise a question to you to consider. We know over here in the southern kingdom of Judah that God had promised to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, beginning in verse 14, that I'm going to establish your throne. What's that mean?
Son after son is going to be.
That's right. Son after son after son after son after son going to be king on the throne in Judah. Does that mean all of them are going to be good?
No.
There were some who were good, there were some who were very good, and there were some who were horrible. All right? But God did not cut off the house of David because He made that promise to David. Now, what does that mean ultimately would come from David as we come over to Acts chapter 2, or perhaps even in Luke chapter 3? Jesus is in the line of David. Now, what we want to see is just how close at times the house of David comes to being cut off. It comes down to sometimes just one fella. Just one man. And we'll see how that the life of that one man was preserved. Why do you suppose it was preserved? Because God said, your house will not be cut off. It might get close. But God did not allow that to happen. Why? Because He made a promise that through the seed of David, Jesus would be born. And if the seed of David is cut off, then the promise of God would fail. Now when you look at the events of all of this Old Testament history, and who did what to whom, we want to be impressed with that. That man's will never, ever overthrew what God promised. Never. Now I want you to picture that in view of what we think of Genesis 3. All the way back to Genesis 3. What's happened in Genesis 3? Sin has been introduced. Who introduced it? Satan introduced it when he tempted Eve. It would seem then that God's wonderful creation has just been destroyed. But God promised that there is going to be a Redeemer. That the seed of woman will bruise the head of the serpent. We see that promise renewed as it was made to Abraham. And as a result, we've got a great nation then developed from Abraham. We've got a place for them to live. We've got a history that begins to unfold with all of these kings. And the relevance of all of that is to preserve that seed until the coming of Jesus. Because that's what God promised. Now what we see in this Old Testament history is how Satan was around every corner trying to defeat the plan of God. But it never happened. Jesus was born just exactly like God said, of the lineage of David. And then can you imagine what a heyday Satan must have thought he had when Jesus was crucified? Finally gained the victory. But then ultimately what happened to Jesus? He was raised from the dead. And what did that do to Satan? It bruised his head. It bruised his head. Just like God said back over in Genesis 3. Now friend, that's the scheme of redemption. That's the promise of God. Now what we want to see, again, as we turn to back to a specific study of the kings, is how that all plays out. Don't get lost in the names. Try to stay hooked up with who is who and who's the son of who and what king or kingdom they rule over. Now, just to throw out another big curve before we move on, is some of these characters in Scripture are called by different names. I know that throws a big fly in the ointment. For example, Ahaziah, we've talked about this. Same as Jehoahaz. He's also called Azariah in certain passages. Young Joash is called Jehoash in some passages. Jehoram is sometimes called Joram. Okay? But we don't want to get lost. We can identify who he is if we look back in the text to see who the father is. See whether he's king in Israel or king in Judah. In other words, study the context. Context, context. It'll help you through this period of time and make your study so much more valuable to you. All right, now let's talk about Jehoram. You saw that circle. This is the one we're talking about, the son of Jehoshaphat. Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat. Well, turn in your Bible to 2 Kings chapter 8. 2 Kings chapter 8. We kind of jumped over a little bit of this, at least today. But I want you to look specifically at verse 16. Verse 16. Now, I'm reading from the American Standard Translation, if you see any variation. It says, "And in the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab," what is he called in other texts? Jehoram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel. It tells us that Jehoshaphat being then king of Judah. Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, began to reign. 32 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. Well, that tells us that Jehoram, the son of Ahab, was reigning as king when Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, became king. Okay? And he reigned, it says, for 8 years. It says, and he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife. Remember our chart? Jehoram walked in the ways of Ahab because he had married Ahab's daughter. Now, is that a surprise to us? Jehoshaphat was a good king, but he had a son that made a foolish choice about his wife. And it turned him to worship idols. Yes. Jezebel's daughter. Yeah.
Mom's little girl.
Yeah. 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 Makes your hair stand up, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hold that thought and go back to our text. The daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, verse 18. It tells us. Okay? Now, next point. During this time, when Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat, is serving as king in Judah, the kingdom of Edom and the kingdom or the city of Libna revolt against the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, one of the things that we've noted already in our study is that it wasn't uncommon during the days of these kings for them to require taxes or tribute from the nations round about them because they were bigger, stronger, meaner, more powerful, so they could do that. But if somebody else becomes king, sometimes we see the complexion begin to change, and it did with Edom and Libna. They said, we don't want to do that anymore. So they revolted. Now, what did that do? That creates a problem. Look, if you will, in verse 20. It says in verse 20, in his days Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah and made a king over themselves. Then Joram, that's Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, passed over Zair and all his chariots with him and rose up by night and smote the Edomites that compassed him about and the captains of the chariots, and the people fled to their tents. All right, we'll have to talk about that, I guess, Wednesday night.
Where is Edom?
Where is Edom? It would be on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. Okay? Now, they're relatives, you remember. All right, the Edomites and the Moabites, they're all relatives, yes. Yes. So, we want to mark where they are. Now, one other thought before I quit talking. You may want to read the beginning of the book of Obadiah. Because it's probable that Obadiah, the prophet, wrote during this time. Obadiah's words are to condemn Edom. And we see that's what happened here.